The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Welcome to September, the most treacherous of months.
President announcing that the U.S. is going much farther than before. This is the most far-reaching COVID vaccine requirements the United States has ever released. These new rules mandate employees at large companies must either get vaccinated or tested. This is a far-reaching measure that the United States had held back on during the Trump and Biden presidencies until now.
I will sign an executive order that will now require all executive branch federal employees to be vaccinated. All. And I've signed another executive order that will require federal contractors to do the same. The Department of Labor is developing an emergency rule to require all employers with 100 or more employees that together employ over 80 million workers to ensure their workforces are fully vaccinated.
Best case, as a practical measure, this is probably going to be a policy that affects the fall of 2022. Certainly not going to be implemented in time for this Delta wave. Now, we've vaccinated 75% of adults over the age of 18. The administration's done a very good job getting this vaccine distributed. We're not going to get above 90%, even with this rulemaking. So we need to ask ourselves whether or not the benefits of trying to get that last 5%, many of which have probably been infected because they chose to go unvaccinated, whether the benefits of that are offset by the impact that this is going to have, the acrimony that it's going to create, the court challenges, the legal challenges.
Welcome to September.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Concerns over the coronavirus, tensions between the U.S. and China, and a slowdown in the economy weighed on the markets this week as we ended over on the negative column. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and gee, it's good to be back. You probably wondered where I've been for the last 2.5 months. I was actually kidnapped and just got free. No, serious. Actually, I had COVID, and we'll be talking about it on a special show I'm doing next week. But let me tell you about today's show. Joining me on the program will be Ms. Schneider. She joins us from Market Gate. She's very bullish on commodities. In fact, it's one of the biggest bullish points of what she sees in the market. She'll be our technician this week. And then also Jeff Christian will be joining us from CPM Group as we take a look at the precious metals markets. And then later on in the program, Chris Sheridan and I will talk about the decade of inflation. All of that coming up. But first, Ryan Poplava on what moved the markets this week.
Well, it was a profit-taking week in U.S. stocks with the S&P 500 index down 1.7% and the NASDAQ composite down 1.6%. Things got kicked off on the downside Tuesday after the long weekend with a reduced Q4 and 2021 GDP forecast from Goldman Sachs. The expiration of unemployment benefits, downgrades for Johnson & Johnson, Merck, and Amgen to equal weight from overweight by Morgan Stanley, and a sell-off in cryptocurrencies that coincided with El Salvador's Bitcoin Day, in which the country adopted the cryptocurrency as legal tender, was unfortunately marred by app complications and protests. So a bit of bad news for Tuesday. Bitcoin started the day at about 53,000 and plunged 19% according to Coinbase before recovering to trade around 46,270. All of these issues helped to set the stage for profit-taking through the rest of the week, and the paltry of bearish news seemed to drown out the good news on Tuesday of import and export data out of China for August that had improved. Another sign through the week that stocks needed a break was the strong auctions for treasuries, with $38 billion in a 10-year auction on Wednesday, with a strong $24 billion auction in 30-year notes on Thursday that sent yields lower for both days, kind of communicating that some air needed to be let out of stocks. The hot producer price index on Friday reversed that trend in yields. Looking at the month change, we saw a deceleration to an increase of 0.7% from 1% in July. The year-over-year increase, however, went up to 8.3% from 7.8%. And with that, bond investors reacted by selling bonds, which caused Treasury yields to climb slightly on the news. So to sum up, strong auctions in Treasuries drove yields lower and may have signaled more profit-taking in stocks on Wednesday and Thursday. Some other news items this week related to economics, none of which really moved the markets as much as that the bond auctions or the negative news on Tuesday. The Fed's beige book indicated that economic growth decelerated some due to COVID. No surprise. In early July and August, businesses are still optimistic about their near-term prospects. Consumer credit increased about $17 billion in July, which was the sixth consecutive increase, and bodes quite well. Airline companies reduced their third quarter outlook on Thursday, but the stocks saw a positive reaction on the news, possibly in hopes that things will change soon, with the Jets ETF up 2% on the day. In some other company-specific news this week, RH and Lululemon had better-than-expected earnings with positive shareholder reactions, while GameStop missed but was rescued from a 10% loss intraday to close up 0.2% by bulls. The retail news helped the consumer discretionary sector fall the least this week, only down about 0.3%, with real estate down the worst, 3.9%, and healthcare behind that down 2.7%. The downgrades in healthcare stocks on Tuesday, plus news Biogen announced it's seeing a slower launch of Alzheimer's treatment, led that group to the weak side. Moderna was a standout after it announced great progress in its portfolio of mRNA pipeline. Now, in politics, Axios reported Senator Manchin would only support $1.5 trillion for any human infrastructure plan. The ECB said it could start reducing its emergency asset purchase program by a moderate pace, and Treasury Secretary Yellen warned of the economic consequences should lawmakers not come to an agreement on the debt ceiling. Also in politics was Biden's mandate on vaccines. Didn't really affect the markets, but it will be interesting to see if there will be any backfire at the worker level should unions or workers decide to boycott work. That could potentially be an unintended consequence and will have to be something that we monitor going forward for the economy. More than 100,000 investors poured about $1 billion into BlackRock's new investment fund in China. George Soros called the investment a blunder and a tragic mistake to put money into China in an op-ed published Monday in the Wall Street Journal. He mentioned a crackdown by the Chinese on private business as of late and of the enormous crisis brewing in China's real estate market. A final story here on Friday that will take some time to unpack is the judge ruling on Apple that it must give its developers the ability to create their own payment options versus going through Apple's payment system. On the plus side for Apple, the judge did say it's not an antitrust monopolist in the market for mobile gaming transactions. The company lost, unfortunately, $85 billion in market cap on Friday as the largest holding in many indices. The drop weighed on stocks overall. So that's it for this week. Not a whole lot of news really driving the market. A little bit of profit taking after record levels hit just last week. Obviously, some reduction in the GDP forecasts going forward for 2021 by Goldman Sachs. And also the strong auctions in treasuries this week gave that similar signal that there are some concerns over that economic growth number going forward. Back to you, Jim, for the technician this week.
Global supply chain expert Dr. Nada Sanders says higher inflation and supply shortages are going to persist much longer than the consensus expects. Here's a clip of what she told listeners on FS Insider this week.
We are looking at a protracted inflationary period. We're going to look at continued and exacerbated shortages of goods. We're going to see higher prices. We're going to see longer lead times for the things that we order in everything from the cars to furniture, appliances, and even food items.
Dr. Nada Sanders forecasted on our show in February of 2020 as the S&P 500 was hitting a new all-time record high that we were going to hit a global recession in 2020 due to the massive supply disruption from COVID in China and its spread elsewhere. That was well ahead of consensus. She also came on our show in 2021 earlier this year and said that inflation would not be transitory against what the Fed and consensus expects, and that it would remain persistent because of a lot of the supply disruptions that we were experiencing. She has been right on both counts, so you definitely want to hear what she had to say. If you want to listen to this full interview and gain access to all of our premium content airing 3 days during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
Don't let higher inflation erode the value of your hard-earned wealth. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Stock market pulling back a little bit this week as we see some internal rotation going on. Let's find out what's going on in the market, what direction it's heading. Joining me on the program is Mish Snyder. She's Director of Trading Research and Education at Market Gauge. Mish, I want to talk about something that happened on Wednesday, and that was like this flash crash in cryptocurrencies. I'd like to get your take. What brought that about, especially when you have a country that's adopting it as a currency now?
Well, there's a couple of things. Some people would be saying that it was buy the rumor, sell the news kind of thing on El Salvador. But El Salvador has a total of 400 Bitcoin. And what's interesting about the El Salvador thing is I actually spoke to a friend of mine who lives in El Salvador. And what they're worried about is that they paid over $52,000 for those Bitcoins. And now, of course, Bitcoin is trading down at 46,200 and change. So there's questions on what happens if they paid up for this cryptocurrency and now it's worth less. Who's paying for that difference? And of course, that would be the taxpayer. So there's a lot of controversy around it. I think that was one of the reasons why it went down. A lot of controversy, of course, with the president of El Salvador to begin with. But on the flip side of that, and we'll get back to the flash crash, but on the flip side of that is you now have a lot of Latin American countries also looking to potentially switch to Bitcoin, like Honduras and Guatemala. There's even talk of Mexico and Brazil. So if we're starting sort of this trend here, the implication obviously is very bullish going forward. Now, if you forget about all of that and just look at the coin itself, it had become extremely leveraged. We had the long weekend. Of course, we know Bitcoin trades 24/7. So people were buying. And then as Tuesday hit the market, the dollar was a little stronger. So that's part of it. Then people just started liquidating. And that's where you had the crash all the way down to about 42,000. The biggest impact was a lot of the exchanges couldn't even handle the load. The volatility went crazy, and then it kind of settled up back at around that 46,000 level, which is what we're seeing right now. That's one big reason. Gary Gensler, the guy who is the charge of the SEC, is another reason whether or not anybody pays attention to that longer term, who can accomplish what he wants to do, which is basically regulate the entire area of cryptocurrency, which would be unprecedented because they're trying to make coin into a security. And we know the SEC is supposed to just regulate security. So his damning remarks didn't exactly help. But again, you've got a lot of people buying it and accumulating it at this space. And if we don't break down from here, I think we're still going to go much higher.
Yeah, I wonder, too, if the article in Barron's this weekend had some impact on this in terms of his role or wanting to regulate more of the markets.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the whole idea is really it brings into question, like, what exactly is the SEC considering a security? And they would like to call all crypto a security, and that's just not the case. So it seems that he's taking on a lot. What he's trying to do is take something that's supposed to be apolitical and turn it into something more political. It would disrupt innovation, free trade, small startups. Basically, it would really piss off the retail investor. So it's not very popular, except with a lot of the more traditional folks who still speak very much against Bitcoin. I can't remember his name right now, but you know, people are saying, oh, it's over, it's a bubble, Janet Yellen being another one. And yet, that's just Bitcoin. Of course, what we know is we've got all these other coins emerging, and then there's Ethereum, which has risen in market cap while Bitcoin has fallen in market cap. And Ethereum looks really, really strong, as well as some of those other alternative coins like Cardano, Solana, which went to new all-time highs, and the countless others. If you look at the list, it's well over 100 at this point. So they just keep coming up with new ones and new ones and new ones. So it's going to be really hard for Gensler to accomplish what he's setting out to do. And it's just one of the many agendas he said he was going to take on this year. And of course, we have yet to see anything real in terms of sinking your teeth into coming out of any of his particular peeves, like selling short, for example.
Mish, what role do you think this will play in its impact on the dollar? If more and more countries from El Salvador, others start adopting this, and maybe this catches on, what does this potentially do for the dollar?
It will not be a good situation for the dollar. And that's one of the reasons why the central banks and the head of the SEC and the Treasury Secretary are trying so hard to come up with some level of regulation. They're able to manipulate the dollar, as we know. And so the fact that this is something that they cannot regulate and is really completely anti-regulation means that if the more popular it becomes or the more adopted it becomes, and of course, we know all of these other corporations are looking at it as well, like Square and PayPal, and then, of course, MicroStrategy. Michael Saylor bought 300 Bitcoin the day that El Salvador bought 400. So think about that, right? I mean, he almost bought as much of an entire country did. I think that the impact would be negative, the dollar. And the dollar has other issues, even if it's not cryptocurrency, it's digital currency in other countries, like, for example, China. And even here, they're talking about trying it. But the other interesting thing I just read about the dollar is that one of the reasons of inflation, even though we think that the dollar going down would be typically really bad for inflation, what it's actually forcing us to do is having the cost of our exports so much more expensive than the cost of importing. And of course, with a supply chain problem, people are saying the dollar is actually too expensive. So the dollar could get hit for both of those reasons.
So along the dollar lines, let's look at the commodity sector right now. And I'd like your take on gold and silver and copper here.
I am so happy you asked me these questions, because I have been, for lack of a better word, obsessed with the whole idea of the metals and the precious metals. I think when we talked before, we talked about that the inflation was really more of a food-driven inflation. And certainly we still have major drought happening and Mother Nature wreaking her little havoc all over the place. But a lot of the food prices have come down, while in the meanwhile, we have all these metals, particularly those that are trading in London, like copper, nickel, lead, and zinc, starting to move up. Aluminum at the highest level since 2008. And then all of a sudden you hear Guinea has a coup, something that I haven't heard the word coup used in a very long time. So getting back to gold and silver, I think gold is so ridiculously undervalued. If we take a look at gold versus, let's say, the Dow, price-wise from 1980 to now, the Dow is worth about 35 times more than gold, just in terms of the pure ratio of price. And it's a rough guess right there. But that, what does that tell you? That equities are pretty overvalued, and gold and silver are very undervalued. And I do believe, regardless of what happens with Bitcoin, that gold right here, I've been telling everybody to buy it. I don't think you have much of a risk. Maybe, you know, I think it should hold somewhere around $1,790 if you're looking at the actual cash price. If you're looking at GLD, I think it should hold it around $165. And we get through this $168, then $170, $171 in the GLD, or $1,840. I think that we could have a rip your face off type rally because it's been so held down, also manipulated, which of course in turn will help silver. Now, copper, of course, more from the industrial use, also came off a lot. And we're looking actually to buy that as well. We're just waiting a little bit here for a setup. We're looking at FCX, which is Freeport-McMoRan, or even the ETF COPX. I like metals. That is my major focus right now as we get into the rest of 2021 into 2022.
You know, you talk about inflation, and if we go back to 1980, gold was 800, silver had 50. Fast forward to where we are now, gold's around 1800, got up to 2000. Silver briefly got up to 50 bucks in 2011. But if you look at silver right now at 2425, when it was 50 in 1980, it seems like silver's got a big catch up.
It really does. And actually, the rule of thumb is that the ratio between silver and gold is somewhere around 16 to 1 normally. And when the silver starts to move up and bring that ratio numbers in, people have looked at that as like the ultimate inflation indicator. And we're certainly not seeing that yet. Gold is still well outperforming silver. So there are a lot of people that are asking me about silver, and they're calling silver still sort of the poor man's gold. And of course, now let's bring into actual currency, which if it's going by the wayside, the whole idea of physical money, that could actually be a threat to silver because a lot of coins are still made from silver, not as much as they used to be. And gold is a whole other different ballgame. It really is a hedge. So a lot of it is going to depend on why the metals are going up. If it's a pure inflation play, then silver could definitely have serious catch up. If it's more geopolitical in nature, also a possibility, then gold will continue to outperform silver. Nonetheless, they both will actually benefit from any kind of major rally from these levels.
All right, let's turn our attention to the stock market. Technology still performing well. We've seen some rotation earlier in the year, kind of like economic recovery stocks. You saw financials do well. Energy was doing well. Materials and industrials. What's your take on the 10 sectors now?
Well, I believe that along with the inflation, we're going into basically a slow growth period. We could even call it stagnation, which is hence the word stagflation when you put the two together. And I see that all over the place. Besides the fact that our labor market is just, it's really crazy right now, actually, that people don't want to go back to work. And there's all kinds of reasons for that. So you have a situation here where just by the mere fact that people aren't out there working, you have a labor market that's creating a slowdown. On top of that, given recent events, which I don't like to get into the political arena, but considering the popularity of the Biden administration has gone down while they're trying to get passed through a $3.5 trillion budget, spending budget on top of a $1 trillion infrastructure budget, those all of a sudden don't look so easy to pass through. And then you add on top of that, the cost of goods going up, of course. And you put that all together, where is the growth coming from? So I don't think we're going into a recession, but I think in terms of you're looking at those areas you just mentioned, Jim, retail, the industrial manufacturing, transportation, the financials, we're going to go kind of range bound where we could go down and maybe hit early 2021 levels and hold there and maybe sort of bounce around for a while. And when I say a while, could even be over a year until there'd be some such catalyst where growth would really start to come back. What that would be, I'm not sure yet. But maybe it would be midterm elections. Maybe it would be as we go into 2024. I think we're in for a rough period, and the market will reflect that. Technology is outperforming, but as we know, gravity takes over at some point, and everything comes down. When things start to settle or get to a bottom of a range, I'd probably still look to technology first. But what these other indicators are looking at, these 10 sectors you're talking about, it's telling us, it's telegraphing to us that we're in for a slowdown.
Yeah, because I take a look at some of the hiring numbers, and then I take a look at some of the retail numbers. And I like to, when I go to the mall or the shopping mall, I like to talk to the salespeople. What are you seeing? What's traffic like? What are people buying? Are they spending? And I've seen a noticeable change probably in the last couple of weeks just from talking to people. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens if they can get this bill through. But, you know, let's look at it from another perspective. When the government is spending as much money as it is right now, the Fed is printing as much money as it is now. Michelle, how do you get negative on this market?
Because at some point, all the money that they're printing, that's what I'm saying. I'm not negative. I do think we could hit a point of support. And if we just look at, let's say, the Russell 2000, which is my favorite index to look at because of the fact that it is so heavily in the United States. In fact, all 2000 stocks in the basket are in the United States. If we just look there and then we go back to 2021 levels, which is not even that far from now, you know, we're still talking about from these levels, maybe a $30 or $40 move lower, which could be another 10, 15%. That might feel like a crash, but generally it's a normal correction. And I think that that would stop us from having a crash. But at what point are people becoming sort of impervious? Now, we do know that there's been a mass exit out of high corporate bonds, but yet they're still buying junk bonds. And that's where your risk on is still there. So I would say rather than try to guess when we might see a bigger 10 to 15% correction from these levels, watch those bonds, because that will tell you that the Fed maybe tapering and not telling us, number one, or that the risk appetite for junk and high yield is waning. But the printing money right now, we have benefits going away. Will the government come in and add more stimulus? I don't think so. And the Fed is being accommodative, but I don't think that that means that they're going to continue to, they're not going to increase it. Let's put it that way. They're not tapering, although they're talking about some slight taper. It'll be insignificant. But again, it may not necessarily hold the market at these levels. And I do believe that the growth slowdown, even if the Fed continues to pump, where are they going to go? Even the ECB came out today and said they have to taper a little bit. And I think that's kind of the direction, because the awareness of what they're doing with inflation has finally hit not all the Fed members, but a good deal of them.
Yeah, you know, as I look at this market, we own a lot of dividend blue chip stocks. And, you know, I'm not interested in bonds with yields like this. But the only thing I find of value, quite honestly, is in the commodity space.
Oh, I love you for saying that. Yes. Well, first of all, you know, I'm an old commodities trader. I was on the Commodities Exchange in New York, actually the World Trade Center, very poignant subject this week. And so I might cut my teeth trading commodities. And it's been 40 years, Jim, since we've seen commodities start to do anything interesting compared to equities. At one point last year, we were at a 100-year low in terms of equities to commodities. So I'm with you all the way. I just had a whole big thing with all of my members today. I did a coaching session live, and I told them, please don't bother me about why aren't we buying this equity, because we're going to be buying commodities. And we're really trying to load up. We already are about 75% of where I want to be in terms of holding gold, which is about 15% of our overall portfolio. And I want to actually tip that scale to have more commodity than equity.
Yeah, I think this is going to be a roaring decade for commodities. Well, listen, Mish, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you do at Market Gauge, how could they do so?
Well, we have obviously our website. We write a daily blog. I am very active on Twitter, and that's at Market Minute. I take the time to answer everybody's questions, especially when they're intelligent questions. and the other way really would basically be if you go to Market Gauge YouTube channel. We have a YouTube channel. I do a lot of interviews where I talk about this a lot with specific picks, et cetera. So you just go to our YouTube channel, Market Gauge, and start watching some of the videos, including this one. Hopefully will be up, not a video, but audio at some point.
All right. Well, listen, Mish, as always, a pleasure to have you on the program. Stay safe and come back again.
Policy strategist Bruce Melman joined FS Insider this week to discuss his most recent third quarter slide deck titled Failures, Fallout, Predicting Politics and Policy in the Post-Pandemic Era. Bruce explains the lessons from history and how they relate to today when it comes to perceived policy failures, what trends it accelerated, and the backlash that came from it. Bruce also looks at the impacts we should likely expect in four key areas: geopolitical, markets and media, science and tech, culture and politics. Here's a clip of what he told listeners this week on FS Insider.
In 2020, COVID was, for all the right reasons, the biggest news story by a million miles. Let's look 20 or 30 years ahead. Will it simply be that, you know, a global pandemic has happened in, you know, 1968, has happened in 1957, has happened in 1918? Is that going to be the thing that changed the world the most? Or might it be something, you know, adjacent or downstream, such as some kind of merger between AI and biotech, DeepMind's AlphaFold 2, finding ways to predict the folding of proteins. You marry that up with mRNA, which allowed us to come up with vaccines so much faster. I tend to think that the story that we're not necessarily looking right at, but that will have changed the world the most, will be something regarding healthcare.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, the talk on Wall Street is the inflation we're seeing today is only temporary. What would this mean for the stock market and commodities? Joining us on the program from CPM Group is Jeff Christian. Jeff, let's begin with gold. A couple months ago, everything you were talking about was inflation. The inflation numbers, CPI, PPI were going up, and we were seeing the inflation trade. You had gold going up, copper was doing well. Then the Fed had a meeting, said they're going to start raising interest rates. Now we're not concerned about inflation, and the metals are down. What's your take here?
Well, let me correct one thing you say. You said, you know, a few months ago you were talking about inflation. I wasn't. I have been one of those people who looks at the actual data and the underlying economy and was saying, yeah, this isn't temporary, but it is transitory. There are some long-term inflationary, more static and secular inflationary pressures, but most of what we've seen in terms of inflationary pressures have been of a transitory nature. And from a long-term inflation perspective, I'm of the view, as are most mainstream economists, that deflationary pressures are much greater than inflationary pressures on the long term. So I see this as a transitory inflation thing. And we warned our clients accordingly, you know, back when the price had fallen down to $1,690 in March and April for gold, you know, we had said, yeah, it could get back up to $1,940 or so. We were wrong. It only got to $1,925. But, you know, it's a temporary type of thing. And so I think that, yeah, you have seen a lot of people who jumped on the inflation bandwagon. Some of them are now reevaluating their position. And you continue to see a very mixed economic picture in terms of the statistics that are coming out, with a lot of indications in our view that what you really have are a lot of transitory things. And it's very funny because if you go back then, you know, we were saying, look, we think this inflation is going to be transitory. We had clients who said, oh, you think it'll be over by July or August? And we said, no. We think it'll be over by July or August 2022. You know, this is when we say transitory, we don't mean a month or two. We're talking about 12 months or so. And if you go fast forward to July or August of 2022, you're going to be measuring price levels against price levels in July and August of 2021. So you're going to see much smaller percentage increases because the percentage increases have occurred, and they were large this year, partly because you're measuring it from 2020 to 2021. If you look at the annualized rate of inflation for most of the components of CPI and PPI, and you measure the annualized rate from 2019 to 2021, you're still in that 2.7% annualized rate. So, you know, there's every indication in our view, in our analysis, that you're looking at a transitory blip in inflation that's taking inflation back up to the levels that it was in the late 80s, which was a fraction of what it was throughout the 70s. So that's my inflation take.
Let's take a look at some of the other aspects of the market. We have gold, we have silver, we have copper. We're going more towards this green economy. What's your take on copper, Jeff?
We've been writing a lot about copper. You know, we're actually positive on copper, but we're not as positive as the people who are. I think there's a lot of overemphasis on copper as the green revolution, green energy revolution, as they're calling it. And I think that there are several things that are wrong. And we've got a lot of data looking at, you know, copper reserves, reserve base and resources, really going back to the 1950s. The world's not running out of copper. There's plenty of copper around. We have some shortages, and we have, for example, a current account deficit in newly refined copper supply coming into the market this year relative to fabrication demand. But those are more a function of management issues and economic and governmental issues that are man-made, as opposed to the world running out of copper. So on the supply side, there's plenty of copper there. We just need better management, both on a governmental level and in a corporate level, to get that copper produced. On the demand side, which I think is much more important, I think a lot of people are grossly overestimating several things about how fast demand will rise. And, you know, one of the things is that they confuse economic reality with political aspirations. So, for example, you had Biden, the president, say a few months ago that he wants to see, he has a target, which is really aspirational, that half of the cars being bought and sold in America in 2030 be electric vehicles. But if you look at several factors, that's not going to happen. First off, there's not enough electricity. And even if we ran flat out in a well-organized and managed level, there wouldn't be enough electricity in 2030 to supply that level of electricity for that many electric vehicles. The second thing is the grid hardly supports the current conveyance of electricity, which is why we keep having problems with the grid in Texas and elsewhere. And the grid, you know, we've known that we needed to modernize it for decades. But again, managerial and political issues have kept it from happening. But the real kicker is the cost of building the capacity to build all those components for the original equipment manufacturers that make the parts for the auto industry. There's a tremendous amount of capital that's required to go into making motors and controllers and contacts and connectors and batteries and the components of batteries, from graphite and lithium to manganese sulfate and cobalt sulfate and nickel sulfate. And the capital is not readily available. And the technological uncertainties as to which technology is going to prevail is keeping that capital from being available, along with other factors too. So, you know, we look at the green energy revolution and we say, you look at the International Energy Agency, they're saying that by 2050, the major source of energy for humans is going to be oil. The second largest source will be natural gas. Renewables may start rivaling natural gas by 2050, but by 2040, they are a distant fourth. And coal will be the fourth largest source of energy, having come down by 2050 to the levels that it was at 2008, which was significantly higher than it was at, say, 2000. So we are still in an industry, in a world that realistically cannot move away from hydrocarbons to an electric or hydrogen economy that fast. And that means several things, including the demand growth for copper and silver in electric vehicles or whatever the next generation of propulsion technology is probably going to be a lot smaller and a lot slower to materialize than a lot of the copper bulls say.
All right. So if we're looking at that, what about all of this government spending? They're talking about an infrastructure package of $1.2 trillion, reconciliation package of $3.5 trillion. I think the additional spending in total will be $6.5 trillion. So we're going to put this money in the economy, Jeff, and how are we going to pay for it? We're going to borrow or the Fed's going to print. You don't think that'll have any impact on inflation?
I think it'll have some impact on inflation, but if you look at the correlation between money supply and inflation since 1980, 81, the correlation has been extremely low. And that has to do with a number of issues related to how the Fed will pump money into the economy, either because of a problem, 1981, 1983, double dip recession, 1987 stock market crash, recessions in 2000 and 2001, the global financial crisis in 2008, the pandemic in 2020. The Fed will pump money into the economy to stanch the bleeding and help support the economy from rolling over into a depression. And time and again, since 1983, when you're out of that crisis, they sell bonds and they sop up the excess liquidity. And as a result, you haven't really seen excess money supply have an inflationary consequence since 1983. And that's probably going to continue. Now, we're at a whole nother level now with $6 trillion in the last 18 months. And that's on top of a budget deficit that went from $460 trillion in 2015 to $1.4 trillion under Trump per year. That's the deficit being added to the debt. You know, we're in a whole nother place than we were from 1980 through 2017, 2018. But that said, it looks as though this is, in fact, manageable. Inflation comes from two sources. One is excess money supply, which has not had an inflationary consequence for 40 years now. And the other one is real economic supply and demand of goods and services to people. And there you're seeing those transitory pressures for higher inflation now, but longer term deflationary pressures in terms of excess labor, computerized manufacturing and service provision, and even agricultural services now being computerized, reducing manufacturing, excess manufacturing capacity, excess commercial real estate, excess retail capacity. You have these enormous excess, not just in the United States, but on a global basis. And all of those are asserting disinflationary, if not outright deflationary pressures. So I think that you put that all together and you can say we have some transitory inflationary pressures, but the real problem in terms of pricing is deflationary. And deflation is much more corrosive of economic activity than is inflation.
All right. Well, let's move on to the industry itself. We've seen a lot of these companies, whether it's Barrick Gold or it's Newmont, at $1,800 gold, Jeff, these companies are making a lot of money, and we've seen it reflected in either stock buybacks or, you know, some very big dividend increases. I'm thinking of Newmont, which raised its dividend 70%. So what's your take on the mining stocks?
Well, there's several things. I mean, first off, there's nothing wrong with paying dividends. And in fact, we've been a critic of the mining industry for decades saying, hey, where's the dividends? You know, where's the payoff for the shareholders? The reality is that the mining industry for many decades sort of dumped on its shareholders. And if it ever had any excess money, it went out and overpaid for overpriced competitors and did M&A. And so one of the things that you're seeing now is that the management is actually paying attention to the owners of the company and saying, hey, you guys deserve dividends. And here are some. The other thing is the stock buyback, which is occurring across industries as you see a decapitalization of industry. You know, the stock market has ceased to be a place for capital formation for industry. And it's really, you know, I've said it for years and somebody picked up on it recently. It's really much more a casino. But what you're finding is a decapitalization across businesses. And that's happening in the mining industry, too. You'll hear people say, well, we're not finding new big gold properties. And that's true. But if you deconstruct the data, people are looking at really poor quality data on how much is being spent on exploration. Exploration spending, if you adjust it for inflation and if you adjust it for the changes in the way the data is collected by the major data collector, if you adjust the exploration expenditures have fallen sharply since the 90s, and they haven't gotten up. So, you know, we're not finding gold or silver or copper or cobalt because we're not looking for it. In addition to that, you know, we're spending less in real terms on exploration. And a lot of the exploration has gone from grassroots geology to looking at computer databases of past discoveries. And that's a real problem for gold, because if you look at every major discovery since the 1840s, gold, every major gold mining district that's been discovered has been discovered as a unique geologic anomaly. Gold has never been discovered in mass where you would think it's going to be. This is true in California, Nevada, Australia, South Africa, where, you know, Ghana. And so if you're sitting there with a high-priced computer and you're doing computerized modeling and saying, where was gold discovered in the past and where can I find property geologic formations like that? And you go look there for gold, you're far less likely to find the big mother lodes that have been discovered where no one would look in the past. You know, so I think there's a lot of problems with exploration and exploration spending. And that's why you're not finding large deposits. If you put the money into the grassroots geological exploration, I think you, what you would find is you'd find a lot of properties. Unfortunately, a lot of the undiscovered properties that you're going to find probably are in China and Russian Far East. And those places are kind of shut off from Western stock markets. You know, those things will be financed by Chinese and Russian and allied investors rather than through the Toronto or London or New York stock exchanges. So I think that there's some long-term issues there. But, you know, the mining industry shouldn't be chastised for giving dividends. They might be chastised for goosing their stock buy, through stock buybacks, but they should also be chastised for not really running their exploration and development programs as effectively as they could or should. And I'll add this. When you talk to senior managers at a lot of gold mining companies, they're pretty much totally oblivious to the economic realities of exploration expenditures.
All right. Well, Jeff, given that, I mean, would you be investing in mining stocks right now? Where would you be putting money to work?
Well, I like physical gold and silver as long-term investments. So I'm buying the underlying commodities. You know, if you want to buy gold, buy gold. If you want to buy gold mining companies, I think there are some nice things out there, but you have to be very careful about it. And I think that the stock prices reflect the fact that a lot of investors have historically been turned off by the returns offered them by the mining industry, not just gold, but across the mining sector, so that you've got a significant reduction in investments in those companies right now. But, you know, that said, there are some companies that are well managed, that have enlightened management, that are actually paying attention to stuff, you know, that have actually gone off to a jewelry or an electronics factory and said, hey, you're major off-takers of my product. How do you use this stuff? Show me your factory. Take a tour. A lot of mining executives have never been to a jewelry manufacturing facility, have no idea how their gold is being used.
Well, listen, Jeff, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about the work and research you guys do at CPM, how could they do so?
Well, www.cpmgroup.com is our website. There's information about our various reports and consulting services. There's an area which is something like our market views, which has all sorts of free reads. Also, we have started about a year ago, I guess, or maybe it was 2 years ago now, doing weekly and now biweekly videos, which we post on YouTube. So you can go to YouTube and you can find a series of videos on a variety of issues, both commodities related and also macroeconomically related, that will give you a flavor of the granular, you know, macroeconomic top-down, microeconomic bottom-up work that we do.
All right. Well, listen, Jeff, thanks for joining us on the program. We hope to talk to you again in the future.
Though the Fed is likely to begin tapering their asset purchases in coming months, they may not ever hike rates during this economic cycle. That's the view of David Avardson, Chief U.S. Strategist and Director of Research at Alpine Macro, who joined us this week on FS Insider to discuss their upcoming investment strategy conference, the key topics and speakers that will be presenting, including their outlook on U.S.-China rivalry, investing in conventional energy versus green energy, and much, much more. Here's a clip of what he told listeners this week.
We would not be surprised if the Fed does not raise rates this cycle, and that the next time there's any kind of a slowdown, and that may even be the fiscal drag next year, but maybe it's an actual slowdown, that U.S. bond yields will go down to Japanese and European levels.
To listen to this full 30-minute interview and to gain access to all of our premium content airing 3 days every week through our website or through a podcast app of your choice, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button. For a large number of reasons, 2020 will turn out to be one of the most historic years on record, not the least of which is because it marked a major turning point in global monetary policy to a de facto embrace of modern monetary theory. Now, there is no conscious or overt endorsement of this view by government leaders, but nevertheless, post-COVID, we have seen the largest amount of spending in history with little thought to the consequences in terms of debt or inflation. In fact, the consensus view has been and continues to be, oh, don't worry, inflation is just transitory. Well, if you've been listening to our show and following us for some time, you'll know that we've taken quite a different view on this. And Jim, starting in the spring of last year, you began warning, both on our show and through a series of articles titled The End of Money, that inflation was not just coming, but that hard assets would be the main beneficiaries. And as we all know, inflation has definitely taken off, and we have seen a big move in hard assets over the past year and a half. Given that the title of today's segment is The Inflationary Decade, I'm guessing, Jim, that you don't think that this trend is quite over.
Yeah, Chris, I don't see any way out of this. And if you look at the way we talk about inflation, most of us, when we think of inflation, we think of the consumer price index, the producer price index. But one of the things that you'll often hear from people on Wall Street, well, you know, the Fed printed a lot of money, but where's the inflation? Well, when money is created, when the Fed goes out, prints money, buys government bonds, they don't control where that money goes. And as we have long maintained on this program, that money has three outlets. It can stay in cash. You can keep it in the mattress, or you just keep it in cash at the bank. And as we saw in the financial crisis, when the Fed came and began to print money, in the last decade, a lot of that money stayed on the balance sheet of the Fed. Even though the Fed expanded its balance sheet by over $4 trillion, a good bulk of it stayed on the balance sheet of the Fed. In other words, it remained in cash. The Fed started to pay interest on cash balances. And instead of a lot of that money going into the economy through bank credit, Banks just decided, remember, they lost a lot of money during the mortgage crisis, so they were trying to rebuild their balance sheets, so they were reluctant to lend. So a lot of the money instead went into the financial market. So when money is created, it can go three places: cash, in the mattress, the economy, and financial markets. And the main depository over the last three or four decades, because people would argue, well, take a look at the money supply. Where's the inflation? Well, track the money supply and track the stock market. It's one of the outlets that money goes to when it can't find a rate of return. I mean, you get nothing on cash. So, Chris, we're looking at a stock market where the PE multiples are right back where they were during the tech mania. So, you know, when you talk about inflation, you got to look at not just consumer prices, you got to look at where money might go. And one of them is the financial markets. And we're seeing that reflected today.
Yeah, and I want to read a paragraph from what you wrote in the spring of last year with your first End of Money series. You talk about how as inflation picks up, quote, you say it'll be necessary to switch over to hard assets. That's what the smart money will be doing now that we've seen a lot of this money printing come through. And you talk about how, you know, we returned back into the gold market after a long hiatus, but also real estate, raw materials, agriculture, and companies that have strong monopolistic pricing power, strong balance sheets, and competitive moats. That these are all the things that investors need to be really focusing on going forward. So certainly that was a great call from last year. And again, if you think there's any debate right now about whether inflation is going to be transitory, back then, over a year ago, there was still a lot of people thinking that, you know, the deflationary pressures were still in place, as Jeff Christian even said. And, you know, I thought it was interesting what Jeff said in your last segment with him, where you were talking about the inflationary outlook, because he said, yes, he believes that it is transitory, but in his view, transitory meant over a 12-month period. So I guess it all depends on how you define transitory in that case.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the financial markets, in the 90s, it was financial assets that were the outlet of Greenspan's money printing. I remember 1999 when we were worried about Y2K and Greenspan really expanded the money supply and the stock market went bonkers. And then if you take a look at the 00 decade, it was a decade of inflation, but most of it showed up in commodities. That was the decade where gold went from 250 all the way up to 1900. Silver got back up to 50 briefly. We saw copper prices go up, real estate prices go up. And so it was a decade of commodities. Then the last decade was about financial assets. So if you had money in stocks and bonds, that was the depository for a lot of the money the Fed was creating, because a lot of the money that they created really didn't go into the economy. It stayed on the balance sheet in the Fed, or it went into the financial markets. Now, fast forward to where we are today, and we're seeing basically alternatives to cash. We're seeing the rise of cryptocurrencies. People, and if you look at cryptocurrency, another way to look at it is it's cryptocurrencies are kind of like a currency. So if you don't trust currencies, which are being devalued by central bank policy with MMT, people are looking for alternatives. And those alternatives are going to be commodities, hard assets, cryptos, whatever it is, a safe depository from something that's being debased and depreciated. Now, I want to talk about inflation from a larger macro point of view. And this is something I think that a lot of people missed. And I picked up a lot of this, and I want to give a lot of credit to Jonathan Tepper and Denise Hearn in the book they wrote, The Myth of Capitalism. In fact, Chris, we interviewed Jonathan on that book. They talk about three things that changed. And you think about the inflation of the 70s, it was a lot of it was commodity prices and labor costs. Labor unions were very strong. And as Tepper talked about, labor unions lost a lot of their power with one of the forces for deflation, which was globalization. Companies began shifting factories over to Mexico, to Asia, and other parts of the world where the cost of labor was cheaper.
so that weakened the bargaining power of unions. A second factor that came in was demographics. With the inflation of the 70s, mom went to work. So you now had a whole new pool of new workers, women, entering the worker force. So how does that portend the future for inflation today? If you look at all around the globe, we have aging populations. China is in big trouble because not only do they have a lot of economic problems, a lot of debt, but one of the issues China is dealing with is when they had their one-child policy is they have an aging population with fewer workers coming behind that to support it. So look at Asia, particularly China. Take a look at Europe, where populations are aging and people aren't replacing themselves. In other words, the average married couple is having like one child. So, and then also look at the U.S. Now, the U.S. is better than most because of our immigration policies that are coming in, and that's where we're getting a lot of the younger workers. So demographics, an aging population with fewer workers behind. Oligopolies, and I talked about this in a piece we did several years ago called Land of the Giants, and that's oligopolies. And it really hit me because I'm doing some research with COVID and things like that. We're looking at drugstores. If you look at drugstores today, they've consolidated. There's basically two of them, CVS, Walgreens. Walgreens bought out Boots in Europe, the largest drugstore chain, and they also bought Rite Aid. And then you have CVS. So, Chris, look at every industry. Look at airlines. There's mainly two of them. Boeing and Airbus account for about 80% of airplane production, and the rest are the other companies. But as you go towards oligopolies, what does that do? It gives companies pricing power because you're basically eliminating your competition. And this is no more visible than in the tech industry, where you look at some of these big behemoths, Google, Facebook. They simply buy out, something comes out like Instagram or YouTube, they simply buy it. And so as the industry consolidates, and the best example is the Wilshire 5000, there's only about 3,500 companies left. So, and I was just reading in the Wall Street Journal, this year is just a record year for buyouts, mergers, and consolidations, record investment banking revenues as more and more companies buy out other companies. You're seeing it in the energy patch. You're seeing it in the drug and healthcare industries. You're seeing it in industry itself. So as more and more of our companies go towards oligopoly status or monopoly status, you're seeing this big concentration of industry. And when that happens, profit margins go up. Return on equity goes up because there's less competition and you get pricing power. It's something that, you know, if you study Warren Buffett likes companies. He calls them strong moats. What is a strong moat? Is basically what Buffett likes is oligopolies. So two macro factors, demographics, aging population, fewer young workers. Second, oligopolies. And number three, the reverse of globalization. One of the things that we're dealing with right now, and we found this out with COVID. I can remember one of my clients telling me they had trouble getting their prescription medication when COVID first broke out because the supply chains, most of the drugs that you get today, even though they might be American companies or European companies, they're manufactured in China. And we're seeing this, Chris, with supply chains. And so, you know, it began with President Trump, but they're also talking about this continuing today. So when it comes to, for example, computer chips, you know, we're really at risk if something ever happens to Taiwan Semiconductor. So if China goes after Taiwan, so Taiwan Semiconductor is building a factory in Phoenix. So we're trying to bring production back because of these supply chain disruptions. And Chris, these supply chain disruptions are going to drive up costs and they're not going away right away.
Oh, that's for sure. Yeah. And that was actually something we discussed this week on FS Insider with Dr. Nada Sanders. She's a global supply chain expert. And the message that we were trying to get across to people is the Fed doesn't have a mathematical model on how global supply chain disruption is going to factor into inflation. They're obviously watching what's happening from the incoming data, but they don't have any way of predicting if the global supply chain is going to heal, how quickly it's going to heal, and the pass-through effects from that on inflation. And as we're seeing, the supply chain disruption is continuing to last longer than the consensus expects. And she believes we're not going to really see a return to some type of normalcy when it comes to the ability to supply goods and prices coming down, back down for shipping, and a lot of the disruption that we continue to see that we see right now, not until probably 2023. So, I mean, just from a global supply chain perspective, in the near to midterm, we're probably looking at higher inflation even over that period. And that's just one component of the many things that you just laid out.
Yeah, and it's being driven also, in addition to those three macro factors. Other factors are government policy. If we take a look at unemployment benefits, the government is giving people supplemental checks on top of the local unemployment. And Chris, if you look at it from a worker, okay, so let's say the minimum wage, I don't know what it is, 11, 12 bucks, and you're making 15 to 18 bucks on unemployment. If you look at it from a worker's point of view, why do I want to go work for $11 or $12 an hour when I can get $15 to $18 on unemployment? So businesses, I mean, even around here, some of the local restaurants, McDonald's were giving sign-up bonuses to get workers. There's like 10.5 million job openings, and there's what, close to 9 million people unemployed. So government is creating incentives that are driving up costs, because if workers have to compete with $15 to $18 of unemployment, the only way they're going to be able to compete is to raise wages, give up or give sign-up bonuses. That's driving up labor costs, which drive up costs. Energy policies, the Biden administration coming in, getting rid of the pipeline, cutting back on fracking. Look where your gasoline prices are today. They're about a buck higher than where they were a year ago. And the United States, instead of being the world's number one producer, has receded. And we are now asking OPEC to produce more energy, because anything that we make, it takes energy to make it. It takes energy to transport it. So as gasoline prices go up a buck, that's going to be reflected in the cost of goods that are shipped. The other thing that we have is, once again, the government is allowing these monopolies to come together with companies buying out the competition. And more importantly, and this is where it really is driving inflation, is this fusion of modern monetary theory. So unlike the financial crisis, where the Fed just printed money and a lot of it just stayed on the balance sheet of the Fed, this time the government is actually putting money into people's pockets to spend with those bonus checks that they gave out to everybody last year. You know, they're talking about supplemental income that they want to get out. So they're giving people money to spend and putting that money into the economy, and the Fed is just coming up and mopping it up with printing money.
So it's interesting, because each one of these forces, we've spent a podcast alone. I mean, you've interviewed people on each of these areas and some of the inflationary impacts that are expected from this. But just to outline what you discussed, I mean, we're looking at demographics, how that's inflationary. That's something that we've discussed in the past. Disruption to the supply chain that is ongoing, and the reverse of globalization with U.S.-China rivalry, that's also inflationary. Record government spending and an embrace of modern monetary theory, of course, that is inflationary. Industry concentration, which we saw go into overdrive once COVID hit, right? Because then all of a sudden the economies were shut down. Small businesses were the ones that were affected the worst. The large companies, they were able to stay open for the most part. So people flocked to those, while the small businesses went out of business. So we've seen a massive ramp up in industry concentration. That's inflationary, right? There's less competition. And then obviously the energy policy with the Green New Deal and spending on less efficient forms of energy. Many people have admitted that, even those that are in favor of green energy admit that it's not as efficient, but they believe that the trade-off is better if you're reducing carbon. But there's a cost there. That's inflationary. So all of these things together are lining up for, as you believe, an inflationary decade ahead. What are some of the consequences for that in particular that you're looking at, aside from inflation, of course?
You know, eventually where this is leading, I mean, basically the government spending is on steroids. This is basically financial suicide. I mean, the government's budget is going to be $6 trillion for 2022. The Biden administration is talking about an additional supplemental spending of $6.5 trillion. So they passed the spending bill at the beginning of the year. That was $1.9 trillion. They're talking about an infrastructure bill of $1.2 trillion. Then they're talking about their green social deal of $3.5 trillion. And Chris, this is going to drive our budget deficit to the point, I mean, and look, folks, it's not just the Biden administration. Trump was running trillion-dollar deficits. And we were a growing economy growing with trillion-dollar deficits. So Washington has adopted this MMT that basically says you can print and spend as much money as you want because you can just simply print it to pay for it. So this, I was watching, I'm trying to think of the economist's name, but he said, you know, the anchor was asking him, what are the consequences of this reckless spending that we're doing now? He said, eventually it's going to be the collapse of the dollar. The dollar will be devalued and eventually, you know, it will lose its status as the global currency. Now, why that's important is the U.S. can export its inflation. We pay for things in dollars, which we create. Well, imagine what happens if the dollar is no longer the world's reserve currency. So the policies that we adopt domestically could impact the value of the dollar. What, imagine if the dollar lost 20-30% of its value against whatever that global currency is going to be or whatever they do to replace the dollar. Then the real impact of our government policies are going to hit us hard because we won't be able to transfer that globally to the financial system and export our inflation. So he said one way to avoid it would be to freeze all government spending today and reduce government spending by 1% a year over the next two decades. If we did that, we could avoid a dollar collapse. But Chris, you cannot be running multiple trillions. I think, what was the deficit last year? Over $3 trillion. You can't run that kind of money, even in an economy as big as the United States, without consequence. So eventually, Chris, this is all going to lead to dollar devaluation. And I want to point out, I'm in the Jim Rickards camp, that it won't be devaluation against another currency. It's going to be devaluation against gold. And the reason, if the U.S. was to devalue its currency against the euro, the yen, what would the Japanese government do? They would counteract that and they'd devalue their currency, or the Europeans would devalue the euro. So one way to get around that and have a true devaluation would be against gold. And that's what I think you're going to see happen.
Okay, so let's go back to some of the investment implications here, because as we discussed last year, and as we've been discussing our show for quite some time, you're making a pretty bold call in the spring of last year, calling for much higher inflation and a rotation into hard assets. At this point, since we have seen inflation figures pick up dramatically since, obviously we've seen a number of commodities either hit new all-time highs or surge back to at least where they were in 2011 at the peak of the last commodity cycle. At this point, what would you say in terms of, you know, investment implications for hard assets?
There's four things I would be looking at: commodities, inflation hedges like TIPS, which are Treasury inflation protected securities, hard assets such as real estate, and companies that have oligopolies, monopolies, or have pricing power. And with commodities, Chris, I have four favorite commodities. Well, actually, I have five: silver, copper, gold, energy, and agriculture. Because those things are going to be key in this next decade. But I'm looking at these in terms of a whole decade, because at some point, the Fed is going to start tapering. And I don't even know if they get to the point of raising interest rates. Just by pulling back of the $120 billion they're printing a month, think of the pressure that's going to put on the Treasury market if the Fed pulls away from the market and we're running this insane spending spree that you're seeing coming out of Washington. I mean, literally, we're committing financial suicide for this kind of spending. You can't, spend $6 trillion on a government budget and then another $6.5 trillion on top of that and not worry about what this is going to do to the debt, especially if the Fed starts pulling back on what it's printing. So I'm looking at a larger macro call that I think is going to last this decade, not just something, because what could happen if the Fed, right now, we are entering a stagflationary economy. The economy's slowing down, inflation's heating up. So something you're going to hear a lot about, a word called stagflation. Slow economic growth, rising inflation, and those are going to favor these kind of assets. Now, if we go into a recession caused by Fed tightening, then that would actually cause a pullback in commodities, because if you're in a recession, you're going to consume less energy. But what do you think the Fed's going to do coming out of a recession? If the government is spending 25% of GDP now and the economy's growing and the Fed's printing $120 billion now in good times, what are they going to do in the next downtimes? Is it going to be not $120 billion a month? Is it going to be $200, $250 billion a month? And are the deficits going to be $4 and $5 trillion? And that's by mid-decade, we're going to be in a crisis mode. I see an energy crisis mid-decade based on what we're doing right now. We're having our Western oil companies divest themselves of oil assets. And we're trying to go to this green energy. And Chris, energy transitions, you don't get those done in 10 years. 10 years from now, everybody in the United States is not going to be driving an electric car. Every gas station is going to be replaced with an EV charging station. And where are we going to get, and you're going to run all this on wind and solar? That's not going to happen. And so I'm taking a look at this strategically over a 10-year period, rather than what may happen in the next 2 months or 3 months. And a lot of big money is going into this area. We have a special program, an AI program that tracks money flows, and a lot of it underneath the surface is accumulating hard assets. And you're seeing it also, Chris, in real estate prices. I mean, yeah, you know, here it literally has gotten to the point where California's definition of a millionaire is a homeowner. I mean, try to find something here in San Diego that's under $1 million. It's ridiculous in terms of the prices. So, but anyway, I would have a diversified hard asset portfolio, commodities, inflation hedges. If you're in bonds, I'd be in inflation protected bonds. I would have hard assets, everything from real estate and regular stocks. I would be looking at oligopolies and monopolies. These are companies that have the pricing power to raise prices with high profit margins.
So in sum, Jim, we're looking at an inflationary decade according to a lot of these long-term structural forces that we outlined today. Whether or not we're going to see the high rates of inflation that we've seen so far, if you look at the producer price index, for example, I think it's at 6%, 7% now. We're back at 1970 type levels on some of these metrics. We might see those back down in terms of the high year-over-year growth rates, but the long-term, again, we're talking about a long-term macro view here. The long-term view is for inflation to likely trend higher for most of this decade. And so in that case, you want to have a diversified portfolio of hard assets. As you warned last year in the spring of 2020, we would see a big pickup in inflation. That has happened. You said smart money is going to start rotating into hard assets as they see value there. That has happened. And as you mentioned today, you believe that trend will likely continue as well. So good things for all of our listeners to consider. And as always, we at our company, Financial Sense Wealth Management, do the due diligence when it comes to how to invest around these various areas, whether it's silver, copper, gold, agriculture, energy, whether or not you want to be in the underlying ETF, or if you want to be in individual companies, which companies to be exposed to. We look at the balance sheets. We do all of the research that needs to be done to make sure you're positioned accordingly. If you want to give us a call, our advisors are standing by and can assist you. Our number is 888, that's 888-486-4000. 3939.
And by the way, I want to mention, you probably noticed that I haven't been on the show over the last couple months. I went through a bout of COVID, and on Monday, we're doing a show on lifetime planning on how I had COVID and survived, and you can too. It's a personal story that I want to share with you, and that will be on Monday's program. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Sheridan and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here in the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, well, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.